This is Aviator Cast, episode 24, Shooting for the Moon.
Calling all aviators, pilots, and aviation lovers. Welcome to Aviator Cast, where we close the gap between real aviation and flight simulation. Climb aboard, buckle up, and prepare for takeoff. Here's your host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. I daydream of flying, even though I fly myself. Like many other aviators, I can't wait to get back up there. It's a dream come true every time I fly. I'm the founder and owner of Angle of Attack, a flight simulation training company, which is bringing you this podcast today. Aviator Cast is a weekly podcast where we talk about the spirit of the aviator. We believe flying is an art form, one that we have to continually practice and master. This mastery is gained through a focus on continual learning, human factors, humility, and a commitment to excellence. Each episode of Aviator Cast will have real flight training and flight simulation topics, or an interview with an inspirational and influential aviator. Our desire and mission is not only to create awesome aviators, but also bridge the gap between real aviation and flight simulation. Show notes, transcript, community discussion, and links for this episode can be found by simply going to aviatorcast.com. So thank you for joining us on this, the 24th episode of Aviator Cast. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here with us. We have a follow-up today with our very own Nick Collett, who joined us in episode 8. But before we get to that, we have our weekly review that comes to us from iTunes. This comes from Henri99 from the Netherlands. Very cool to have you guys from the Netherlands leaving reviews. He says, very good, 5 stars. If you like aviation, this podcast is a must-have. I do not fly, but love simulation, and this podcast has both great interviews, inspiration, and linking the virtual world with the real world. Also, thanks to this podcast, my book library has been expanded with great titles. So thanks, Henri. Really appreciate that review. And if you also want to leave a review for this show after you're done with this episode, or even while you're listening to this episode, the primary place to do that is on iTunes. This is where most people find out about our podcast, and it just helps us grow a little bit each week as we continue to release these free episodes to you and continue to get good guests on the show. You know, we put a little bit of time into this, so all that we ask is that more people hear it. That's all we want at the end of the day. So we're excited for this episode. Nick is a longtime friend of mine. He's also worked with me quite a bit. His lifelong dream was to become an airline pilot, and he started off as a very, very young boy, learning with simulation and just learning what he could along the way until he recently got hired by an airline and is now flying passenger service. We're going to hear the last part of Nick's story today. We kind of left you on a cliff last time, gave you a bit of a cliffhanger. So now we're back with Nick on part 2. Now, if you want a little bit more context, make sure to also listen to episode 8 of Aviator Cast, and that is where Nick had his part 1. So let's get right into it. This is Hangar Talk with Nick Collett.
Now, a special Hangar Talk segment.
All right, everybody. We are going to have Nick back with us today for episode 2 or part 2. Of the conversation that we had with him earlier in episode 8. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm good, thanks, man. Very good. Sitting here, middle of the night, but happy to talk away about airplanes, as always.
Yeah, it's a little difficult. You being in Europe, me being in Alaska, and us having a time where we can get together and kind of chat. So I'm glad we are finally able to do this because, you know, I think you actually kicked off the Hangar Talk episodes. And it just ended up being so great that we have met with a lot of people since then. But I've just been jonesing to get back with you and hear the rest of the story. So that's
yeah, it's
why
great.
We're
it's great,
here.
Great to be here. And you've had a lot of interesting people on the show, which has been really good listening for me. So yeah, very glad to be here again.
Great. So how we left it off last time was you were sitting on the runway, ready to go on your base training in the actual aircraft, your first flight, if you will, at the controls of a jet. And yep. That's kind of where we left it off. And I think we'll just kind of go from there and get your story.
Sure. So I talked about the type rating at all, or
we went through the entire type rating and talked about what the training was like and how your simulator experience helped you out. So I think we covered all that pretty well. I think we're up to the point where you're actually going to fly the airplane, sort of thing, or you're rather at the controls. Maybe you're not flying the airplane yet, but it's kind of where I think we got to.
Well, I was, and essentially when you do a type rating, your first type rating, at the end of it, you do 6 takeoffs and landings to complete the training, which in our case was 6 touch and goes. And it's a very intimate experience with the airplane because there's no autopilot. You may or may not use the flight director or the auto throttle, it depends. But certainly completely manual flight and visual flight completely, because you're doing visual circuits at an international airport. It's unbelievable. And yes, as you say, it's your first experience flying a jet. So for me, it was the realization of a dream that I'd had since I was very, very young. And it was a tremendously, tremendously special day for me. One of the best days of my life, without a doubt. And it brought forward a lot of emotions for me and the guys that I was doing the training with, because we were all achieving something that we'd been wanting to achieve for many, many years. And we'd put a lot of work into getting there. And finally, we were about to step foot in this aircraft for the first time and go flying. And it was a really exciting experience, and I'm glad to be able to share it with people. Because it's something where on the internet you read people's first experiences flying jets in their blogs or maybe the odd YouTube video, but no one really seems to talk about it in any great detail, which I find odd because it's such an important step for any pilot. So I'm glad to be able to do that here.
Great. Yeah, I'm sure I speak for everyone and I say we want to hear all the details and kind of what the whole process was like.
So, yeah, I'll do my best. It was only a few months ago, so it's pretty fresh, and I don't think it's something I'll ever forget. So,
well, yeah, and even since then, I mean, you've been flying the airplane in actual passenger service, which
yes,
so
yeah, I carried my 10,000th passenger the other day. I've been keeping a log, you know, after every flight, note down the number of passengers on board, and you can tally them up. And I got to 10,000 the other day.
That's pretty so, cool. Do you just yeah, see that it's with a nice Log thought, 10 isn't it? Pro or?
That's right. Yeah, I do. And I put in the remarks section after the flight, my role, pilot flying, pilot not flying, the flight number, the number of passengers, the type of approach, the runway and so on. Just so I have a tally of, you know, how many NDB approaches I've flown or how many VOR approaches, how many raw data approaches, what technique we've used for each approach, just some details, you know, to remember the flight and anything out of the ordinary that might have happened.
Right, yeah, maybe a lesson learned. I kind of like that about the new digital logbooks. It's almost like
you've got limitless space.
Keep a journal. Journal of your flights and what happened, because, you know, we all have memorable flights, but the longer time goes on or the further time goes on, we forget about those flights and how special they were to us. So little details like that are cool to be able to put in there, whereas in a newer, or rather an old flight book, or logbook, you would have very limited space and you had to really get good at writing in tiny, tiny handwriting in order to fit any amount of information in there. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
All right, so take us from where you were on the runway. So you had go ahead.
Yeah, so we'd done the simulated time and we'd done what's called the license skill test, which is the final sim that you do with a type rating examiner. And you do a pretty standard profile with engine failures, maybe a fire, different failures in the en route phase of the flight, and the climb out and the descent. You'll do missed approaches, a raw data ILS, non-precision approaches. I did a captain incapacitation as well.
Oh, wow.
And then, which is it's actually great fun in a way, because you're flying the aircraft alone without support. But yes, and then it culminates in this base training, which is circuits. And so we were going to do this very early in the morning. We had a morning slot, so I think we were going to get to the aircraft at 6:30 a.m., something like that, and fly through till 11 with three of us on the airplane, three students, and a captain and a safety captain who was going to occupy the jump seat to make sure that, A, everything was being conducted safely, because obviously the captain is focused on monitoring our performance and making sure that we fly safely. But if the captain is incapacitated for some reason, then sure, we should be able to land the airplane no problem, but we have no experience. And right. So they put a safety pilot there for that reason.
Seems wise.
Yeah, it's just, I'm sure it's standard anywhere at any airline. And so we get to the aircraft in the morning, and I'll always remember it. It was a cold, wet, dark, really unpleasant morning. We arrived at the airplane in the bus. There were no stairs at the plane. The door was closed. The bus doors opened, and it was raining cats and dogs outside, and we just sort of sheltered in the bus until the ground crew brought the stairs along, attached into the airplane, opened up the door, and we climbed aboard. And aircraft was cold and dark, no electricity at all, and so they plugged in the external power and we started to wake the aircraft up. And this was my first time on a 717. I'd barely seen a 717 before. I mean, in Europe we don't have very many of them, and probably the last time I'd saw one was in Heathrow, I guess, years ago when they used to fly in there. Mm-hmm. And so it was surreal, you know, to be type-rated on this airplane that you barely see.
Right, you're no longer the kid on vacation going up and asking the pilots if you can sit in the cockpit. You're going exactly. up there to do your job.
You're right, and I still feel that, you know, every time I walk into the airplane and I turn left instead of turning right, it's a sort of defining magical moment for me. Anyway, so we get on board and start to wake it up, and the captain, well, the two captains are doing all of that, and the three of us are in the cabin, myself and the two guys I was training with. And the question comes up, who's going to go first? Because the person who goes first is going to do the takeoff and the cockpit preparation and assist with the taxiing and so on. And then the next two are just going to take over in the air and complete the training. So I was quite nervous, to be honest, because, well, two reasons. Firstly, it's an emotionally important moment because it's the first time flying a jet, and it's only an experience you're only ever going to get once in your life. But also, I suppose you had the responsibility of starting the aircraft, and you didn't want to look silly in front of the captain that you're flying with in case you didn't know quite what to do, because you've only just finished your training.
Right.
And so I volunteered to go second, maybe a bit cowardly, but I thought, you know what, it'll be nice just to stand here and observe everything and have a fairly easy introduction to it. So we got the aircraft started up. We had to do a manual load sheet because it was an empty flight, and we didn't have the computing to do it with the ground handling. So we did a manual load sheet and gave it to the captain, who checked all of that. And then we started up and off we went, taxi to the runway, took off. I was in the cabin, of course, with the other guy while the first trainee was flying the aircraft. And we actually had to fly an IFR departure, a SID, because at that point it was an IMC conditions. Mm-hmm. And we took off planning to get radar vectors for the first approach because it was forecast to improve and we wanted to get the training done. It was very safe, and it was a good experience for this guy being able to fly a standard instrument departure on his first time flying the jet. So he had a great time doing that, and then he did his circuits. And then I was sitting in the back counting the touch and goes, and one, two, three, four, five, six, and we get to the sixth one, and I know that once we climb out from this one and we're on our downwind leg, it's going to be my turn.
Great.
To take the seat. And, you know, the heart starts beating and you're getting more and more pumped for it, and you're starting to realize that your dream, literally, I know it's cliched, but your dream is about to come true, you know. And, yeah, sure enough, the cockpit door pops open, and he jumps out of the seat, and he has probably the biggest smile I've ever seen on anyone's face. Because, you know, he's just, he loves airplanes as much as I do. He's a very good friend of mine, and he just had a wonderful time, and he flew the aircraft beautifully, you know, very, very nice landings. And I was sat there in the cabin while he was landing thinking, geez, I've got to match this, you know.
It's nice.
The pressure is on. And so I take the seat, buckle myself in, I put the headset on, and then suddenly you realize that, geez, this isn't a simulator, you know, you're sitting in the real thing. And you look out the window and you've got the land down below you. You were at maybe 2,000 feet at this point, with the clouds floating past. And this is a moment to be absolutely present in the moment and just enjoy it, because it's a raw pleasure that you will not experience again the first time flying a jet.
Definitely.
So, yeah, sat there. And the captain sort of looked over at me and said, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Yeah, as I'll ever be." and for the changeover, the autopilot was on, of course. So what was left for me to do was to disconnect the autopilot and start flying. And so from the moment I pressed that button, I was then in control. And I knew that pressing that button was therefore going to be effectively the start of my career and a very important moment for me. Before I did it, of course, I needed to adjust the seat and get myself in the perfect position and make sure I was absolutely comfortable.
Which I did. Is probably rolling it back.
Well, actually, because the rudder pedals are adjustable, I probably have the seat in the same position as anyone else, because you need to have the seat positioned correctly. Mm-hmm. So that your view out the window is correct and that your position with regards to the flight controls is correct and that your view of the instrumentation is unobstructed. So the seat position actually is fairly fixed, the ideal position.
Gotcha.
It's just the up and down for your head height and the rudder pedal adjustment for your legs.
And for the listeners, anyway, the reason I mentioned all that is because Nick is quite a tall guy. What are you, Nick? 6'3" or something like that?
No, more than that. 6'5", I think.
Oh, wow.
6'4", 6'5", really cool. Yeah, about 2 meters almost. With shoes, probably 2 meters. Anyway, so, yeah, it's interesting flying this aeroplane because it's not the biggest. Anyway, so I'm sat there and everything feels completely different to the simulator, because in the sim, obviously, it's dimensionally identical to the aeroplane. It's like they've chopped the nose off and stuck it in a box on legs. But in the sim, you have no natural light. It's all artificial light. So right. It's like flying at night. But in the aeroplane, of course, you've got the sunlight coming in. And so everything felt very, very, very different to the sim, mm-hmm. even though it's all the same, in effect. It's just the environment that's different. And so it was a bit of a shock in a way. But as it turned out, of course, I adapted to it quickly. Anyway, so the time came to push the disconnect. And I did so. And then pushed it twice to silence the warning. And of course, when the autopilot is connected, it trims the aircraft pretty much perfectly. So when you disconnect it, there's nothing to do, really, because right. the aircraft is trimmed. So nothing really happens, but you know that if you make any inputs, the airplane will respond. So just to make sure that I was actually sort of in control, obviously I knew I was, but to satisfy my curiosity and my will to see the airplane move as a result of my command, I just nudged the controls to the left and then to the right a little bit, just to, you know, just to feel the airplane move. And sure enough, you know, you're moving a 52 ton, well, it wouldn't have weighed that much, of course, when we were empty, but moving an airliner with one hand.
Great.
With no hydraulic assist or anything. Unbelievable. And then the time came to turn onto effectively a base leg for the circuit, which meant rolling the aircraft into a 25 degree, more or less, bank. And that was then the first maneuver that I was doing, was just a turn in straight and level flight. Mm-hmm. And away we go. So I, one hand on the controls, one hand on the throttles, roll the aircraft into this turn, and unbelievable. It was an overwhelming experience at the start, both in terms of the emotions that you're going through, realizing your dream, but also because you're so focused on wanting to get this perfect. You know, you've got the captain in the left seat, you've got the safety pilot behind you, and you want to make a good impression.
Right.
So initially, to be honest, my eyes were glued on the PFD, on the flight director, and on nailing the speed and the altitude. And then finally, when you remind yourself, hang on a minute, okay, I've got this lovely EFIS in front of me, but this is a visual exercise because I'm flying circuits. So how about we look outside?
Right.
And when you look outside and you see the world moving past you and you see the horizon rolling as you turn the aircraft, then you start to feel that, geez, this is real. You know, you're actually flying. And so we turned base and started descent and then start to maneuver onto final visually, just looking at the runway, just like a Cessna. And you're calling for the flaps and the gear and landing flaps from the captain, and you're asking him to pre-select the missed approach altitude and so on in case you have to go around. And then you're up on final approach and you've got, you know, the biggest runway you've ever seen in your life in front of you, big international airport. And, pappies on both sides, and at this stage the auto throttle was engaged for the first circuit. I thought it'd be prudent to leave it in because I wanted to be focused on the hand flying, you know, mm-hmm. and letting the speed management be largely up to the aircraft, although I was monitoring it, of course. And so the auto throttle in this aircraft, it does a great job of maintaining the speed. And so we're flying this lovely stabilized approach on glide slope, on localizer, speed is good. The runway is getting larger and larger in the window. And then you start to realize that, crap, I've got to land this thing, you know. it's not flight sim anymore. It's a rather expensive asset that is in my hands.
Right.
And although you've got a training captain next to you, you still feel like you want to do a good job. And of course, you're approaching the runway faster than any other aircraft you've flown before, so everything happens a lot faster. And you've got the radio altitude call-outs coming in, and then you start to hit 50, 40, 30, 20, blah, blah, blah. And these are sounds I've been hearing in flight sim for, you know, 18 years or something.
Right.
And now I'm hearing them for real. And to be honest, I don't know how good my first landing was. I recall that it was on the center line and it was in the touchdown zone, mm-hmm. and no one screamed. So I think it was quite good. It was probably fairly firm. I think mm-hmm. most of them were, you know, because you haven't got any real finesse in the aircraft at that
right,
stage.
Of course not.
And when it's empty, it floats forever. So you need to put it down really. And I was so focused on the flying that I would probably have pulled off I could potentially have pulled off quite a hard landing, and I wouldn't really have noticed because I was so focused on flying the airplane.
Right.
And so we touched down, lower the nose wheel onto the runway, stand the thrust levers up, and then hand them over to the captain, who sets takeoff power. And he then reconfigures the aircraft, retrims it. The safety pilot gives the go-ahead to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And
how long is this runway that you guys were using?
It's 3,300 meters long.
Okay. And how long is that in feet? I guess three times that.
Yeah, times it by 3.28, I guess.
It's something like 11,000 feet, yeah, or something.
It's very long. It's a long runway. Yeah, but about 10,000, 10 kilometers. So it's sorry, 10 kilometers, Jesus. 10,000 feet.
This isn't a space shuttle runway.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sorry, it's late. My maths is lacking. So yes, it's a long runway. So you got loads of time.
Yeah.
And so they set power, which in this case is only about 88% M1, I think, right, he was aiming for. Because these engines, they put out 21,000 pounds of thrust, which, mm-hmm, is just ridiculous for an aircraft of this size. And
if you're empty.
If it's empty and you set full takeoff power, you'd probably beat the space shuttle into orbit, to be honest.
Yeah, you'd go through the moon.
Yeah, yeah, it's a powerful one. So it's a pretty low thrust setting, but nonetheless, the acceleration is pretty savage. And the nose wants to rise of its own accord, because you don't trim it a huge amount on the runway. So rotation isn't a very big deal. So you rotate back to about, pretty much up to the limit of 20 degrees when you're that light, to maintain your target climb out speed. And climb out, and you start a right turn at a minimum of 400 feet onto crosswind, which is very low to be turning, mm-hmm, you know, normally, but in that case it's what you do. It's safe. It's fine. And so you start this right turn at 400 feet into your crosswind leg and level off at 1500. And although the flight director was on, the auto throttle at this point was off, because once we touched down, the auto throttle was switched off automatically by the aircraft. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm drinking water as I speak. And so upon reaching 1500 feet, you need to bring the power back, of course, to level off and reach the target speed, which is about 210 knots, as I recall, I think, and then turn onto downwind. And then at this point, you're flying without the autopilot and without the auto throttle. Mm-hmm. So the workload is increased a little bit from the first circuit. And on the crosswind leg, as I recall, on the crosswind leg, just prior to turning downwind, there was a feature on the ground that you needed to avoid for noise abatement.
A feature?
A town.
Okay.
That you needed to avoid. I don't want to be too specific because I don't want to reveal where it was.
Okay.
But this meant visually maneuvering around this town on the ground. And so now you're visually flying an airplane around an object, which is what you would do in a Cessna, right? But now you're doing it in an airliner. It was just unbelievable. The place we did the base training was very beautiful, very scenic area. And you realize that you're, for all intents and purposes, a tourist in this place that you've never been to before, flying an airliner, enjoying the view, which is just the most surreal thing, you know. And so, yeah, you turn downwind and then you're straight and level for a few minutes, just while you fly to the other end of the runway again. And that's when it began to sink in that it was happening, that I was doing this. And to be honest, there were tears in my eyes. It was a very special moment. I had a huge smile on my face. And I vocalized it to the captain, you know, because he was keen to see my enthusiasm, I think. And certainly if I was in his position with three guys in the airplane who are flying the plane for the first time, I'd be really excited to see how happy they are.
Yeah, I was thinking that a few minutes ago, that'd be a pretty cool job, you know, to be in his position, to kind of be there. That would just be very rewarding, and very rewarding part of the job for sure.
Yeah, you're right, for sure. And I'd love one day to be in that position. But it'll be a fair few years down the line, I'd say. But anyway, so then, you know, rinse and repeat. You get to the end of the downwind leg, you turn right, you turn onto final, you do another touch and go, and the touch and goes kept coming. And I think maybe the fifth one, yeah, and they kept improving. I think they're all fairly good. I mean, the captain had no real comments about it. I remember he made a comment about lowering the nose wheel onto the runway, that you have to find a balance, obviously, between positively flying the nose on, because you don't want to wheelie down the runway, but also not slamming it into the ground. And I think maybe on my first landing, I wasn't quite positive enough in lowering it, and he made a comment about that. But I improved on that, of course, as we went. But then my fifth landing was a little bit off center line, which I never like, whatever I'm flying. But it was, I think it was just a product of a gust of wind or something on short final I didn't quite correct for enough. And I don't know, maybe the left landing gear was slightly to the right of center line. You know, it wasn't big time off. But it was enough that I thought, right, I better nail the sixth one, the last one, you know, make it a good one, because I want my memory of this day to be of good landings, not sort of mediocre, half off the center line ones. And so we took off from that fifth one again, rolled it into a fairly aggressive right turn of 400 feet, aggressive in the sense that, but just by virtue of the fact that you're doing a 20 degree turn at 400 feet off the ground.
Right.
Which is really exhilarating. You feel like you're flying a fighter jet. And then coming back down for the sixth landing, which was by far my best. It wasn't a greaser, but it was a very soft one. And I was very, very happy with it. And then taking off from that again, back into the downwind leg, at which point I handed over control to the next guy. And I left the cockpit with, well, again, probably one of the biggest smiles on my face I've ever had. And literally, I sort of embraced the guy who had gone first, because he was still over the moon about his experience, and I was now absolutely on cloud nine. And yeah, it was tremendously special to share that with the others. Right. And then the third guy did his circuits, and we landed back again. And by that point, the weather was lovely. It was a perfectly clear day. And then and then went back to the hotel for some well deserved rest.
And that was that.
That was that. And I'd always wondered what it would feel like, you know, flying the aircraft, because you know that it's never going to be quite like flight sim.
Oh yeah, of course not. And not even like the multi-million dollar simulators they have, no. You know, definitely not.
No, not at all. That's the thing. And the feeling on the controls was different to how I'd imagined it. Mm-hmm. I really don't know how to describe it. It was a sort of, it just felt so mechanical, which was wonderful, you know? And in this aircraft, it is literally mechanical. It's a direct cable connection to servo tabs on the wings, that on the control surfaces, sorry, that move to fly them into the correct position to maneuver the aircraft. So there's no hydraulic assist on the primary flight controls.
That's nice.
Which is, yeah, it's quite unique,
you know. These days.
No, it's not. And it means that the aircraft will fly, it'll fly an ILS approach on the autopilot with no hydraulic fluid on the airplane, which is unbelievable, you know. I'd like to see a 737 do that.
Or yeah, no kidding. So,
it's a very intimate flying experience when you're flying this aircraft. It's very, very hands-on, which is, it's really good for me in my experience level.
So now, between then and now, you've actually had some experience flying around passengers. What has that been like?
Yeah, I've had about about 200 hours now, more or less, on the aircraft. And it's been absolutely wonderful. I cannot express how exciting the last few months have been. They've been everything I wanted them to be and more.
Great.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Are you finding that you enjoy the cabin crew interactions and kind of the environment and the community and dealing with passengers? Are you enjoying all those aspects of it?
Yeah, all of it. Without exception, pretty much. I mean, it still doesn't feel like going to work in the morning. you take it seriously, like it is, of course. You know, it's in terms of the thrills you get out of it, it's like any recreational activity to you. It's something you want to do. It's something you're happy to get up to do in the morning. But you go at it with a professional attitude, of course, because it is your profession. It is your job. And you attach all the responsibility and pride to that you need to. But
so what's your flying schedule like right now? What's a typical month for you? What's a typical day?
It depends on the time of year. And I won't go into specifics because I don't want to talk about the airline as such, because I'm not representing them at all. Mm-hmm. I'm doing this for me and for you and for the others, you know, not to talk about the airline. We fly in the summer period between 80 and 90 hours a month, typically, mm-hmm. Which is busy, but it's fantastic. It's a wonderful experience for me, and the destinations we fly to are challenging with all sorts of different types of approaches. The airline has a very good attitude to letting us hand fly the airplane.
That's nice.
Obviously, automation is embraced and encouraged.
Of course.
Likewise is manual handling of the airplane, because a lot of the airports that we go to require it because of circling approaches or demanding approaches with turbulence and so on. And so we need to be proficient flying the airplane. I have flown many raw data approaches with the autopilot, with the flight director, with the autothrottle switched off. I've flown countless approaches from 5,000 feet clean. It's been a fantastic experience to hand fly the airplane. Probably quite unique, I would imagine, nowadays. In the airline world.
It is, yeah. That's not something a lot of airlines are doing. And it's actually, I think it's something that airlines want to do, and they're becoming more open to it now because of some of the recent accidents with automation. You know, the Asiana 214, for example, which brings up a lot of different issues. But I think they're just seeing that sometimes automation can be a crutch, and they need to allow their pilots to be able to hand fly. So that's really nice that your airline is allowing you to do that. And, you know, I'd imagine it makes the job much more enjoyable, because it's not just about management, you know, of the aircraft. It's about physically being there and doing something and actually being a pilot instead of just kind of being a driver of the autopilot.
You're right. And I mean, don't get me wrong, when you are... particularly in the descent phase, because that's when you have the most interaction with the autoflight system. When ATC are giving you demanding vectors that maybe require some fairly complex energy management to get the aircraft slowed down and drop down to your assigned altitude and so on, and you do a very good job of managing the autopilot and managing the airplane, it's extremely satisfying.
Oh, of course.
It really is. But there's nothing more satisfying than rolling out of a very well-executed raw data ILS where you disconnected the autopilot and the flight director and the autothrottle at 7,000 feet, you know, before the final vector, and flew a very good approach down to minimums. And then
so they let you disconnect the flight director, huh?
During training, yes, I did that. it's very good experience to do it. I think it's very important.
Oh yeah,
especially during training when you have a safety pilot in the jump seat, because you need to keep those skills. Mm-hmm. Because we've seen what happens when pilots get too focused in the minutiae of the automation and maybe have their heads down a little bit too much and not seeing the bigger picture.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's really unique and interesting. And I think it's one of those issues that is kind of at the forefront of airline safety these days, is kind of the argument between automation and actually hand flying the aircraft and how much the pilot should be involved. Because, you know, on the flip side of accidents like Asiana 214, you see a lot of accidents as well where the pilots could have been using autopilot and they would have avoided a situation, you know. So it's kind of hard to argue for one side or the other, but I definitely think it's good to have a balance between the two rather than too heavily weighted to one side or the other.
You're absolutely right. Yep.
It kind of makes you wonder, just you talking about kind of how your airline does it and the descent phase and how that's a highly, you rely heavily on the autopilot in that situation, and then you being able to do raw data approaches and training, things like that. It kind of makes you wonder how they did it back in the day with these really old jets where they would fly transatlantic, you know, with very rudimentary, if any, autopilot systems. And I mean, just makes you kind of wonder what those pilots were made of.
You're absolutely right. And of course, still, a lot of those guys are around.
Yeah, they are. Still flying. They really are.
And I fly with a lot of them, and it's fascinating to talk to them about that stuff. There was one who I flew with the other day, actually, who used to fly the DC-8, and he had himself, his co-pilot, flight engineer, and a navigator. And they still employed the navigator, although they did by that point have Omega navigation system, which was fairly accurate. You know, and they would set off from Mexico, flying over to Europe, and in the DC-8, and they would get a course from their navigation systems to follow, and the captain would ask the navigator to work out, using his charts and the stars and so on, to work out a course, and they would be within a couple of degrees of each other.
Really?
You know. Unbelievable. And that's just one form of navigation. Yes, of course, you know, flying the DC-9, things like that, before they had INS, just using VORs and NDBs. It's pretty amazing. But the accident rate was a lot higher back then.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because it's much easier to make mistakes with these things. And that's why raw data flying has to be taken seriously when you do it now. You know, you do not do it on an IMC day. You do it on a VMC day where the weather is good and where the captain is, or the other crew member, whoever it may be, is situationally aware and has the capacity to monitor another pilot who is going to be heavily engrossed in flying the airplane. And you only do it if you feel yourself that you are, that you have the capacity to manage it.
Right, definitely. And it's
because safety will always come first, of course. You know, it's all very well training, putting pressure on yourself by doing these approaches for the purposes of training. But if it compromises safety of the flight, then it completely defeats the purpose of doing it in the first place.
Right, definitely. So now that you kind of have some experience behind you, what would be your advice? Just kind of looking back on your life, kind of getting to where you are right now with just starting out your airline career as an actual airline pilot. What would be your advice, say, to a teenager that is using flight sim, they're passionate about flying, they kind of have the means and the medical situation to where they can pursue this thing? What would be your advice for these people? And maybe even those people that maybe don't have the means but have the dream.
Well, it's interesting because you meet a lot of different pilots, obviously, when you're flying. And pilots with different levels of interest and different levels of excitement when they fly the airplane. And I, like I say, I don't get up to go to work. I get up to go and fly airplanes. And I get up to go and do it with all the effort and responsibility and professionalism that I can put into it. But the end reason for my walking, taking the bus to the airport, is because I want to fly.
Right.
And I want to develop my career. It's not to make money. Yes, you make money from it. Wonderful. That's a means to live. But I'm going to do it because I love it. And when I have a change in my roster, or if for some reason the day doesn't go quite like I want it, you know, I get changed to a different captain, or I get a different flight to maybe a less exciting place, I always try to see the bright side of it. That, crap, I'm still flying a Boeing 717. This is, you know, this is a surreal eventuality for me in my life, and it's right. Something I'm tremendously fortunate to do. And so I'm currently seeing the aviation world through a very optimistic and excited pair of glasses, so to speak. And there are a lot of people who see it much more cynically, mm-hmm. and have fallen out of love with it, mm-hmm. and will try to discourage you at all costs from going into aviation. And the number of people that I've had say to me, including pilots saying this to me, you know, go and be a doctor, go be a lawyer, you know, you'll earn more money, and you can buy a plane and go fly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have every respect for doctors and every respect for lawyers, but it's never something I've been particularly interested in.
Yeah.
And I defied these people, and I went and did the training, and now I fly aeroplanes. And I don't get paid a huge amount for it at all, but it is the best thing I can imagine doing with my life, given my interests and right. my dreams. Mm-hmm. So I have no regrets whatsoever in the path I chose to take, and that I was fortunate to be able to take.
Definitely.
Because let's not forget how much it all costs, you know. Mm. And there are a lot of people who simply don't have the means. They only have the dream, like you say.
Right.
But even for those people, there are ways of doing it. There are many ways of financing it. But you take a huge risk in doing so, of course.
Right.
So to anyone thinking you're doing it, I would say that it is the most wonderful, wonderful thing that I can imagine myself doing. And purely by those words, you know, that I would encourage them to follow their dream as I did.
Great. And that's really what it is. It's about the passion. And yeah. And not necessarily about the money. You know, I was having this conversation with somebody yesterday. You know, I could make all the money in the world, and I could move somewhere else and have a different lifestyle. But there's something to be said for kind of finding your place and being happy where you are and being happy there. You know, you may not be making all the money in the world, but at least you're doing something you love doing, and you're in a place you love being, and you're working with people that you love working with, and you maybe you have family around you that you enjoy having around. Keeping those things in mind in building your life, I think, is very important. And for you, you know, that's largely centric around your career right now, and something that you've been shooting for a long time and have been passionate about since kind of the beginning, which we've talked about in the last episode as well. And, you know, there's no surprise to me that you're just totally loving what you're doing, just because I know who you are and how much you enjoy aviation from day to day, you know, and what it means. And I, you know, I've never been able to put my finger on that, really. I've never been able to say, I love flying because X. I could never define it down to just a couple sentences because it's a very deep kind of core thing to me. And I'd imagine a lot of people feel this way about other careers that they have. You know, maybe I'm absolutely sure that there's someone that feels this way as a doctor, a surgeon, or a lawyer. But for us, for you and I, and for many, many of the listeners, you know, tuning in today, that is airplanes and why we're so crazy about them and, you know, why we look up at the sky every time we hear one. It's hard to put a finger on that.
It is. It's very hard to put a finger on. And you know what? I've stopped trying to put a finger on it.
Yeah.
And I've stopped trying to explain it to people because sometimes you will meet people. And I met a lot of these in my flight school, which frankly is disgusting that that's a very strong word, but that people will comment on your passion for something that they're effectively aiming for too, but only for the reason that they had the money from their parents and they thought flying looked cool because they can get women and so on. But to those people, I stopped trying to explain why I found it so wonderful and just accepted that the people who do understand it are the ones that it's really worth getting to know, you know. I was on the crew bus yesterday and we just landed and there was a 777 parked next to us and we were in the bus driving past it, driving underneath the nose, and I had had a day full of aviation, right? Got up at 4 a.m, gone to the airport, driven to the airplane at sunrise with these stunning aeroplanes glistening in the morning sun. Flown for 7 hours or so to all sorts of wonderful airports. I'd hand flown to 15,000 feet. I'd hand flown down from 6,000 feet. I'd spent all day in aeroplanes and I thought I'd got my fix. And then we land and then we get into the crew bus and then we're driving underneath the nose of this 777. And I'm just standing at the window, gazing with awe and love at this huge machine, thinking to myself, crap, I thought I had enough of aeroplanes today, you know? But no, I needed just this one last treat of this 777 right up close. So it's a difficult thing to put your finger on, you're right, but I don't think you should need to, you know?
And really, you know, I guess if I was to summarize, not necessarily how I feel about it, but how to continue on, it would be find those things in aviation that really just spark you, you know, that get you excited from day to day and re-spark that passion you have for it. And, you know, kind of like what you experienced with that 777 in that you had a great day doing all that you did, and not to say that you didn't enjoy that, because I'm sure you did immensely.
Absolutely loved it.
But you still had that spark at the end of the day that you had, you know, you saw that 777 and you enjoyed it and you loved it. I think if we, it's kind of odd because, you know, I kind of foresee that there's going to come a point in your career perhaps where it's dragging a little bit and you need to pick me up. But then maybe your outlet is you go to a 172 and you fly that on weekends and that's how you regain that spark.
Yes. And a lot of people that do that.
Right. And I think that's what we have to find as aviators sometimes. We have to make sure we continue to find that spark to keep moving on. And not to say that spark can't always be there for some people, but for others, it's going to be harder to find that from day to day.
Mm. Yeah. And I think I'm getting the impression that for me, I will always want to be in an airline with the sort of culture that the one that I fly for has, because it is a very good place to work from that perspective. The people are very nice. The culture is exceptional. And I'm very excited to be working here. So I've struck gold, really. I've been extremely fortunate to get to where I am. And every day it just seems to get better. It's a very special place to be in life.
Great.
I think.
Well, I think we've about talked ourselves out of this show. I think we've kind of covered what we came here to cover. It's great to hear your experience about, you know, flying a jet for the first time, what it's been like to fly for your airline, and kind of a little bit about how to keep moving forward, I guess, is kind of how we wrapped up. But thanks for joining us on the show. I know it's late over there. Any last words for the listeners?
It's wonderful to be in a position to be able to try to inspire people to, well, encourage people, you know, to get into it. But I was talking to my mother the other day about flying, and she doesn't have any sort of love for aviation. You know, I'm sure she's interested, but probably only because I'm now involved with it. But we were talking about photos that I've been taking in the airplane, and I take a lot of photos. I love photography, and I'm very glad to be able to mix my profession and photography together to get some pretty impressive photos from the cockpit and on the ground and so on. And I was showing her photos on my iPad that I'd taken of, you know, storms and the cockpit at night and all sorts of things. And she said something that was quite funny. I can't remember if she said it or I said it, but anyway, the gist of it was, I've got a lot of pictures of the cockpit, you know, and or from the cockpit. And I said to her, can you think of any other career where you take photos of your office and it's actually interesting, you know?
Yeah.
it sort of sums up the whole thing. It is a tremendously special thing to be doing. Forgetting about the technicalities of it, just the fact that you are sat in an airplane at 37,000 feet and you've got, you know, the Mediterranean to one side of you and France to the other, and beaches down below you, and maybe a thunderstorm ahead, and the sun streaming down through the cirrus clouds above you. It's a pretty dang special thing to be able to do, to see the sunlight every day, no matter what the weather's like on the ground. It's a very good place to be. Mm-hmm. And if anyone was on the fence about whether to go for it, I just encourage them to think about what they might be missing out on, if they decide to go and sit on the ground for the rest of their lives and not pursue what they truly want to do in their heart.
Love it. I don't know of any better way to end the show.
To end?
Yep, well, that's hey, it. It can't be said any better.
Don't expect me to be able to end the podcast, because I will talk about airplanes forever.
I know, yeah.
So it's probably a good thing I will try.
All right, so it was awesome to have Nick on the show again to wrap up his story on what it was like to fly a jet for the first time and what it's like to fly for an airline. Now, you can obviously tell that this was a very emotional experience for Nick. It's the culmination of so much hard work and so many years of dreaming for this moment. So it was really cool to kind of hear that rawness of just how amazing this experience was for him. And he definitely took us there. Nick has a way with words that can definitely take you to that place and really help you visualize it. It made me feel like I was there. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Huge thanks goes out to Nick for joining us. And if you guys want to leave him a comment, you can go ahead and do that on avietercast.com. He'll probably answer those at some point, but if he doesn't, I'll point his attention to it and he'll certainly see them. So that's a way that you can get a hold of Nick. All right, so we're going to wrap up the show now. We'd love to hear your thoughts on AVietercast. You can truly shape this show and the topics we provide. Take a quick 2-minute survey at survey.avietercast.com. Do you want to be a part of the AVietercast community or leave a comment? Go to avietercast.com to join in, or write me directly at me@avietercast.com. Say you don't want to miss an episode of AviatorCast. No worries, you can subscribe through email at aviatorcast.com, or you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or SoundCloud. iTunes is the main source where people subscribe. It means that you get it every week. You just subscribe to it pretty easy. Also, we'd love to get your honest review on iTunes. This is the primary source that people come and find out about AviatorCast, and it's just a great place where we can get more listeners. So if you do enjoy this show, please go review there, especially if you are outside the United States or the United Kingdom. Even you Canadians, we'd love to hear from you Canadians. We don't have a lot of Canadian reviews. I know you guys are out there. I kind of see the data coming through as far as those listeners that are in different countries. We'd love to hear your story. We'd love to hear how AviatorCast is helping you out. So please leave a review on iTunes, if you will. All right, if you'd like to check out any of our training products here at Angle of Attack, head to flyaoamedia.com. Start with the basics for free with Aviator 90. Learn instrument flying and more with Aviator Pro, or even fly many of the world's most popular jets virtually with our training products for the 737, 747, 777, and MD-11. Again, at flyaoamedia.com. Many thanks also go out to the Angle of Attack crew for all of their hard work to make this episode possible and all they do outside of AviatorCast. We wouldn't be able to do this each week together if they weren't in the background working hard. Last, but certainly not least, thank you so much for joining on this episode of AviatorCast. We are truly grateful to have you here, part of our community, and so engaged in this wonderful passion for flying things. Until next time, throttle on.
10-5-8 is ready. 10-5-8 is the shoreline. Turn left heading 235. Maintain 2000. Runway 25 right. Clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff. 25 right. United 580.